One of the difficulties in going into the world of chinuch, or particularly the world of rabbanus, is that there's something out there called the rabbi's son syndrome. You familiar with this? You've heard of rabbi's son syndrome? Typically, the way it's understood is that when you are the child of a rabbi, you want to be whatever the exact opposite of a rabbi is, because you see that it's no profession for a nice Jewish boy. Dr. Pelkovitz, who's the son of Rabbi Pelkovitz, refers to a group of friends that he had in high school when he was in Tor V'das, Rabbi J.J. Schachter and some others, who were all sons of rabbis, and they got together and they had like a little club, and they used to call themselves Progeny of Orthodox Rabbis, or for short, POR. The idea is that yichus is supposed to be a good thing in Judaism, and generally it is a good thing, but sometimes there comes a certain amount of pressure with it. Typically speaking, though, when you look in Tanakh and you look in Chazal, yichus is most often lifted up on a pedestal. It's a good thing. It's something positive. It's something that helps a person. It's something that encourages a person. I'll never forget, I once asked Rav Schachter, when I was considering becoming a lawyer and I was going to go to law school, I was asking him about Eitzah, you know, in terms of my life's path, and he was asking me, well, what are the milas of this type of law or the other type of law? And I said, well, I know a guy, this fellow who was just made a second siyum on Shas, and he's I forgot what kind of lawyer he was. And Rav Schachter thought for a second, said, yeah, but his grandfather was like a gadol ador. I mean, the kind of zechus avos he has is very unusual. Who has zechus avos like that? And I was thinking, like, in my decision-making process, I never in a million years would have factored in, are my zechus avos going to protect me or not going to protect me in making this decision? Generally speaking, yichus is a good thing. When we discuss villains in Tanakh, like the villain that this week's parasha is named after, we would think we would try to disassociate him with anyone good in his past, with anyone good along the line, because after all, he was a rotten apple. He wasn't good. So the pasuk tells us, Vayikach Korach ben Yitzar, ben Kahas, ben Levi, and it doesn't say ben Yaakov. So Rashi right away comments, Yaakov davened, Yaakov was spared. Yaakov was spared from being associated with this terrible person. Which is nice that Yaakov was spared. Why wasn't Levi spared? Obviously the Torah didn't have to say anything. It could have just said Korach, or Korach ben Yitzar. Why does it have to go so many generations up? Ben Kahas, ben Levi. What did they do? Why did they have to be associated with Korach? So granted, I mean, he was a descendant of theirs, but why draw attention to that in the very first words of the parsha? Second, there is a Medrash Pliya that tries to identify Korach's motivation for rebellion. There are a lot of different ways to identify it if you read through the Psukim and you read through the various Midrashim, but this Medrash Pliya, what makes it a Medrash Pliya is that it doesn't seem to make any sense at all. The Medrash says, Ma ra'a Korach lachlok al Moshe? What led Korach to want to disagree, to want to argue on Moshe? Parshas para aduma ra'a. He saw Parshas para aduma and he said, that's it, I got to rebel against this Moses guy. What in the world is it about para aduma that turned Korach so against Moshe Rabbeinu? What does para aduma have anything to do with any of Korach's arguments? With anything that Korach was trying to accomplish? With any of the people that were on Korach's side? Where do we see any connection whatsoever to para aduma? Finally, a third kasha. There's a very well-known medrash that Rashi quotes that tells us of Korach's public demonstrations that he made in front of Moshe to try to illustrate his point. So what did he do? He took a beged, shekulo tcheles, and he says, Moshe Rabbeinu, if I have a beged of lavan, how many tcheles strings do you need? So, just one string of tcheles. We said probably three-way machlokas rishonim. If you have Moshe Rabbeinu, I'm sure said it depends if you like the Rambam or the Bali Atosis or the Raivit. Okay, three machlokas rishonim, how many strings of tcheles? So Korach said, okay, but I have a beged shekulo tcheles. Does this also need tcheles? And Moshe Rabbeinu said, yeah, of course, you need to put lavan and tcheles on it. So Korach said, aha, you see that? You see how ridiculous the Torah is? Ridiculous how Moshe Rabbeinu is not the Torah. You see how ridiculous what Moshe Rabbeinu's psakim are? If a whole entire beged is good enough with just one string of tcheles, how could it possibly be that a beged shekulo tcheles needs more tcheles? It should cover itself. It's already got tcheles. The whole beged is tcheles. So that's what shows the absurdity of Moshe Rabbeinu's leadership. of all things, to show the absurdity of Moshe Rabbeinu's leadership, such an inane argument. I mean, anyone who's learned, 3 minutes of halacha knows that that's the most ridiculous halachic argument you've ever heard. If you're mamish thinking like an Amaretz, so then that's a kasha you would ask. But if you have any sort of halachic training, you don't ask stupid questions like that. And that was his big show. That was the big deal that he was going to make out of it. So there is a yesod Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky has that Rabbi Yaakov discusses the brachos that Yaakov gave to his children. Yaakov Avinu gave to his children, particularly Shimon and Levi. Yaakov Avinu tells Shimon and Levi, "Achal kim bi Yaakov afitzim bi Yisrael," that for the fact that they went out and wiped out an entire city of Shechem, so their reward punishment is that they're going to be scattered about throughout the entire Jewish people. So what does Rashi say over there in Parshas Vayechi? Achalkim Yaakov Afitzim Yisrael, that they're going to be Melamde Tinokos for Klal Yisrael. So Yaakov Kamenetsky has a very beautiful vart about why Dafka, this jealousy they showed for their sister, the standing up for the sister, wiping out the city of Shechem, means, and acting violently, means that they are going to be great Melamde Tinokos, that they're going to be really wonderful at being teachers of Torah for Klal Yisrael. It's a very nice idea about how the key Nakuda in going into teaching Torah is a love for other Jews and standing up for them and caring for them and being passionate about their well-being, and that was the midah that he saw in them. There's only one problem. If you actually look at that Rashi, he doesn't just say that they're going to be melamde tinokos. Rashi writes, they're going to be melamde tinokos ve'anim, and poor people. So it's much harder to read that as like a great bracha, because you care so much and you love so much, that's why I want you to be, okay, melamde tinokos, yeah, that's why I want you to be poor? Why it happens to be, sometimes it comes with the territory. If you're Melamed Tinokos, you're not going to be the richest guy. But that was why did he tell them that they have to be poor just because of that? So I saw in Mishkan Betzalel, Rabbi Rudinsky explains that the primary sin of Shimon and Levi wasn't in what they did. Their action was actually quite noble. What did Shimon and Levi do? Their sister was taken by a hooligan who was going to abuse her and totally ignore the special kedusha that she had, and they couldn't stand it. No one was doing anything about it, and they couldn't stand to see everyone just standing by watching this happen, no one trying to stop anything, and they went in and they wiped out the entire city. They're heroes. It's a heroic act. So Yaakov says, what are you doing? You're painting a target on us. Now people are going to come after us and attack us. Well, you know what? History proved that Shimon and Levi were right. No one came in and attacked them. They were fine. They were heroes. So what did they do so wrong? What did they do so terrible? So it seems that what they really did terribly wrong was that they had a major decision to make. How to proceed in a time of crisis. And when making that decision, they had this incredible asset that they could have taken advantage of. Namely, Yaakov Avinu. This incredibly wise older man, who also, by the way, happened to be their father. And instead of asking Eitza, instead of asking him, what do you think of this plan? Is there anything we're not thinking of? Is there something that we're missing? Instead of asking, they just go and do. They decide and they do. And that was their shortcoming. To decide that they can take this into their own hands without consulting anybody. Now consulting with a soul, especially when you have someone like Yaakov readily available to you. I remember last year when Rav Schechter came to my shul for a Shabbos, so we had a question-answer session. And the question-answer session, we had people submit the questions in advance, and one of the questions that someone submitted, I submitted it to be honest, but one of the questions that someone submitted was, if you had 1 hour to spend with Rav Soloveitchik today, you come back for 1 hour, what questions would you ask him? What would you discuss with him? So the Rebbetzin, of course, if you ever met Rav Schechter's wife, she's like, let me see that list of questions. And she saw that question. She goes, ha, I know what you do. You sit there biting your fingernails for an hour because you'd be too nervous to talk because you were so afraid of Rav Soloveitchik. But Rav Schechter, his actual response to the question, once he got around to speaking, his actual response to the question was, there's no big ticket issue that I would discuss. There are dozens of things that come up every single day that I want to discuss with him. Dozens of shilas, of issues in Ashkafa, dozens of things every day that I wish I could discuss with him. being notel etza isn't only something that you do for the huge decisions. It's something that we do in the course of life. That's the way we live. We live not only completely. It's not healthy to be completely independent and think that we have the entire picture. It's a good idea to see what other people are saying, to see other perspectives, to appreciate what other people, how other people view a situation. Not to be robots and do whatever other people say, but when you see multiple perspectives and you hear about them so many times. I gave a shiur recently in a shul, not my own shul, a different shul, about paskening shilas. You know, case studies, different shilas that came up. It's like I give the same. It's like it's my shiur every day, every week, but anyway, I tried to discuss a little bit about the theory behind psak, about what these steps in the process are. I went through the different steps, identifying the issues and finding out daraisa drabanan, seeing if there's any shasat sarech or shasat chak or the hefsid meruba, all the different issues that you'd go through in paskening halacha. And then I started discussing the various shailas, the interesting shailas, the ones that I thought were interesting. And someone came up to me afterwards and said, in the course of your discussion, in every single shaila you mentioned what Rav Shechter thought about it, what Rav Marcus thought about it, what your brother thought about it, whichever Rabbanim they were, Willard thought about it, whatever Rabbanim you typically consult with, you mentioned all of them. You mentioned about what each one thought about each Shaila. But in your process of discussing how one passes a Shaila, you never mentioned that you consult with other people. And he was right. It's so pashut. Of course you consult with other people. When you have to make a decision that matters, even small ones, if you really want to get it right, getting other perspectives is critical. So that was the failure of Shimon and Levi. So Shimon and Levi had two ways that Yaakov thought of to address this issue. First, they had to be humbled by dropping to the bottom of the ladder of material success. By becoming aniyim, they'll be humbled. Because there's no one that's more dependent than an ani. He doesn't control where his next meal is coming from. He's dependent on other people. He needs to collect from other people all the time. It's a miserable existence to be so utterly dependent. But this is Yaakov's medicine for them. They were too independent. He needed to teach them a little bit of dependence so that they could somehow, like the Rambam says, end up in the Shvil Azav, end up in the middle. Second, they were going to have to deal with young children. It doesn't say that they're going to be Rashi Yeshiva, Magide Shir, be Yeshiva Gedola. No. It says they're going to be Malamde Tinokos. Deal with the kids, the little kids. Because when you deal with little kids, there's no one as vulnerable, no one as innocent and as needy as little children. They need you to help, tie their shoes and to help, put on their coat and every little thing. When you are a second grade Rebbe or a first grade Rebbe, you are spending as much time dealing with the kids' needs as you are teaching them Torah. And they had to go through that experience of seeing the beauty of a certain type of dependence. They had to see that it's a reminder of their own need for a guide in life, a daily reminder. That you don't grow out of the need, it's just the needs change. You now no longer hopefully need help tying your shoes. Now you need help making other decisions in life. Deciding where to move, deciding who to marry, other decisions that you have in your life. So based on this idea, I think we can answer all the questions we began with. Korach refused to accept that there was somebody who has more authority within the Jewish community than he does. He couldn't imagine that his opinion wasn't every bit as valuable, if not more valuable, than the opinions of Moshe and Aaron. The idea of having someone greater than you to look up to speak to, before acting, it was foreign to him. He had it figured out. Moshe and Aaron were corrupt. He was the man. He was the one that was supposed to be in charge. He had it all figured out. So Korach, while obviously taking the flaw to an extreme that Levi, his Zaydi, never took it to, you see the kernel of that midah in Levi. Shimon and Levi failed to consult with Yaakov, and sometimes with the midah over time and over generations, if not dealt with immediately, can grow and grow and grow. Korach traces, the Torah traces his lineage back all the way to Levi. Not to Yaakov, but to Levi. Yaakov took Eitzah. Yaakov asked his mother every move. before he runs away, before he takes the brachas, everything. He didn't come up with these plans on his own. But to Levi, part of Torah learning, part of the experience of Torah learning, is a certain submissiveness. It's interesting, it's a dichotomy, because on the one hand there's a certain need to think independently and to be strong in the way you ask questions and to be on the attack. But there's submissiveness in a different level, in a different area. There's a submissiveness to the system of halacha, to halachic logic. A person who's not trained in halachic ways of thinking, if you talk to people who've never really learnt, and you try to explain halachas to them, it's very, very difficult. I would imagine it's like a doctor talking to me, you know, if I were to ask medical questions. Wait, how does this little pill make my headache go away? It goes all into my head? Like, how does that work? And the doctor would be like, you're an idiot. You know, I mean, he tried to explain it to me, but I'm an idiot. I don't know what he's, you know, I'm not familiar with pharmacology or whatever. There is a certain logic to the halacha itself, and it's a different kind of logic than common sense logic, than street logic, than what we'd call balabatish logic. What's Korach's question about? Whether this was to be taken literally, his actual question or not, but it's symbolic of what his question was. His question was, I don't want to submit to any other logic. I'm going to ask the most balabatish, amaratish question you could imagine. That to the Hamonam on the street who've never been exposed to anything, sounds like a good question. Oh, so much tchelas. I shouldn't. What do you mean? A beggar at Dal Kafos needs tzitzis and needs tchelas. What kind of kasha? But it shows a complete lack of submissiveness to the halachic system. So what's the connection to Parah Aduma? Because if there's ever a mitzvah that our ego has to move out of the way, and we have to say, you know what? God just knows better. And whether we get it or not, God just knows better. It's the mitzvah of Parah Aduma. Because no matter how wise we are and how trained we are, Shlomo HaMelech, the wisest of all men, Amarti Echem Avihi Rechoka Mimeni. I was so wise, I thought I was so wise, and I am so wise, but it's beyond me. Parah Aduma is just too much. It's beyond me. It's so complex, it's so difficult to understand why it works, how it works, whatever the difficulties are. It's beyond me, it's beyond all of us. And that's where you have to realize that you have to submit. You have to submit to the Ribono Shel Olam. I just want to be very clear about two things. I know it's getting late. Two things. When it comes to being Shaul Eitza, first thing, very, very important. Both are very important. When I say that a person has to be Shaul Eitza, it does not mean you have to ask somebody else what you have to do and follow their instructions exactly. I can't stand it when I'm talking to a kid, an adult, whoever it is, about a difficult situation in their life, about what to do about a particular situation, and I start thinking through the issue with them. And what do they say? Just tell me what to do. It's not that I blame them. It's I blame their entire upbringing. Meaning, you're not supposed to be told what to do. You're supposed to be an independent person. You're supposed to be able to make an intelligent decision. The point of being Shaul Eitza is not to become a robot, not to be told what to do. The point of discussing with people is to see the whole picture, is to frame a way to look at the problem. I remember discussing with my Rebbe of Silver in Karen Biavna a variety of issues. And what he would always do, he would say, okay, the way to think about this issue is that there are actually three separate issues here. There's A, B, and C. There's a downside to A, a downside to B, a downside to C, an upside to this. And he just went through the cheshvonos with me. Never, ever told me what to do. Just gave me a way to think about something. That's what Eitza is supposed to be. And I would be highly suspicious of anybody who gives Eitza in the form of, you must do this. We had a Rebbe's meeting recently in the yeshiva. I don't want to discuss exactly what the issue was, but there was some issue where some Rebbeim were telling kids not to do something, and yeshiva's policy is that we think it's okay that we don't tell kids not to do it, whatever it is. So Rabbi Kamenetsky said, don't tell kids not to do this. I'm like, wait a second. You can't tell kids about the potential dangers in doing this? He said, no, of course you can tell them about the potential dangers in doing this. I said, so what are you talking about? He said, no, don't tell them not to do it. I said, well, when would you ever tell a kid not to do anything? Meaning, unless it's dangerous or it's something that... Meaning, it's an Eitza issue. You know, if it's something that's dangerous or it's an Isser or something. But if it's an Eitza, whoever tells it not to do... You discuss the issue. You don't say do, don't do. I'd be highly suspicious of anyone who approached the problem that way. And the second, I think, very important issue is that Rebbeim are in the habit of giving shiurim about the importance of having a Rebbe. Unfortunately, parents don't give shiurim. So parents can't give a shiur on the importance of consulting your parents. And I've mentioned this in the past, but it bears repeating. When taking Eitza, well, it's also something that happens very frequently. A kid will ask me something, or an adult even will ask me something. And I'll say, what do your parents think? And they'll look at me like I just landed from a different planet. My parents? Why would I care what my parents think? It's like, what do you mean? I love you very much. They love you more. I care about your well-being very much. They care even more. I know you very well, maybe. They know you even better. And of course I want to give aid, so of course I want to help and want to, you know, discuss. But that has to be the number one opinion you take into account. Granted, you don't always have to see eye to eye, you don't always have to agree. There's no mitzvah to agree with your parents. There's a mitzvah not to beferish argue on something that they're saying, not to get involved in their disputes, maybe. But there's no mitzvah to agree with everything that they say. But to listen, to hear their perspective, to be open-minded to their perspective, to appreciate that it's coming from a place of love. You know, as Rav Shechter always says, I'm a member of the parents' union first. You know? Then I'm a member of the Rebbe's union. So I think that's the idea of Korach, the mistake of Korach, not to take Eitzah, act on his own, that midah that he gets, that grew out of proportion from Shimon and Levi, is a midah that we have to be on guard for. It's good to be independent, but at the same time, our independent thinking should be guided by perspectives of other people that are valuable and thought out and clear and contribute something to the way we approach things in life, and we should be zocheh to make all the right decisions. No one makes all